All right, we are on chapter 14, verse 23.
You sound like you've had a day already.
Yes, it has. It's been slaughtered by several people.
Oh.
This is a slaughter. Who's still slaughtering who now?
Yes, it was the 15th year of Amatiao. Yeah. Amatiahu, there is only one Amatiahu. This is Yeravam the second. This is King Yeravam, who rules over Israel for 41 years. So first of all, you know he is a very powerful king. And just to give you a sense of things, if you hold your place there and you skip to chapter 15, verse 1, which is only about 8 psukim below this, or 5 psukim below this, you'll see that it was in the 27th year of his rule that Azariahu ben Amatsiahu rules over Yehuda. He came into the throne at 16, and he rules 52 years. 52 years. So what you have is essentially, yeah, we'll find that he doesn't actually have as long as you would. Yeah, yeah, he's a firm guy, except at the end. We'll see what happens with him. So essentially what you're looking at is this is a golden age, a return of a golden age of Israel. You have two kings on the throne who will see they get along with each other very well. They do not apparently attempt to reunify. I guess that we tried that twice, once by Ahab and once by Yehoash, and I guess they figured we had enough of that. Yehoshaphat with Ahab, and it was also an attempt at reunification, I think, with the two Yehoashes on the throne at the same time. two Yehoashes at the same time, I believe. So, but here there's no attempt, as far as we tell, of reunification. This is sort of a de facto agreement, a real peace between the two countries. So you're talking about two very powerful kings. We'll get into the details of them. So it's a golden age. It's a reemergence of Israel. Anyway, going back to chapter 23. V'shna chamishe shana l'amatzim ben Yoash melech Yehuda, malach Yeravam ben Yoash melech Yisrael, b'shomron arba arba'im v'achat shana. Now, right away, there's a problem. Again, if you look at those two psukim, you can tell there's a problem, and I'll show you why. According to this, he ruled in the 15th year of the Judean king Amatsya. Amatsya ruled for 29 years, although some of them were in exile, if you remember, before he was killed, finally, for losing a great war against Hazael and the north. But he rules in the 14th year, the 15th year of Amatsya. If you go to chapter 15:1, it says in the 27th year of Yeravam, Azariah rules, which makes no sense because it would have to be the 15th year or the 14th year. That is, if Yeravam comes to power with 14 years left to the life of Amatsyahu, that means that Amatsya's son should rule in the 14th year of Yeravam already being on the throne. Yeravam being in the north and Amatsya being in the south. But that's not what happens. It's the 27th year. That's 13 years that are missing. It's impossible for person X to be in the 15th year of the rule of a person who dies after 29 years, which means 14 years left. And then person X's son takes over in the 27th year of the guy who took over. It's impossible. You're just missing 13 years there. It's a tremendous loss. Which means that there's definitely something. It's not like it's not a 1 year problem or a 2 year problem or a 3 year problem. There's a 13 year gap of what doesn't make sense here. So at the end we'll take a look at it. I actually have a little diagram of it, but I do want to print enough a lot of them because it gets confusing as it is, even with the diagram. But essentially, Amatsyahu does not rule. Sorry, Uzziahu, who rules in 15:1, chapter 15, verse 1, does not rule independently as long as one would think. He rules in his father's time. Azariah. Sorry. What makes things also confusing is Azariah is also known as Uzziahu. He has two names, which are interchanging. Yeah. But last time we were here, we saw that there was...
He just got in trouble at the end.
With the Kohanim. We're going to see. He gets a big trouble with the Kohanim. But
trying
he gets,
to be a Kohanim.
Well, trying to be a Kohanim. Exactly right. Hi, good evening.
How are you?
Good evening. Good, thank you. Good.
I'm back.
Welcome back. And I'm almost gone.
Yeah,
so... Hopefully we'll finish the north of Israel falls in chapter 16. And then there's a big Musar Shmuz of why Northern Israel falls in chapter 17. A big, big Musar Shmuz. So hopefully we'll get to that before I go. And then the rest, essentially, you only have one kingdom left, which is Yehuda, and it has ups and downs, some really good times and some really bad times until the destruction by Nebuchadnezzar. So hopefully we'll at least finish that section of destruction of the north, which is the interest of the book, really, as we've seen before. As opposed to Divrei Hayamim, which is interested in the south, this book is interested until chapter 17 in the northern king. Where there was confusion in the previous section with Yehoram, Yehoachaz, Yehoash, that was because people were getting assassinated right and left. It was hard to tell who was ruling in whose time, so there was a great deal of confusion. What we saw is that there were verses which were plucked out of one spot and duplicated in another spot. There was just it's just an editorial mess. I think Yirmiyahu was probably having a great deal of difficulty trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again in a time where kings were essentially being assassinated right and left. Here, it's not really the problem. There's only one issue here, which is the synchronism of the 27th rule, and I'll explain to you at the end of the class, God willing, what that 27th year rule is. It sounds like he comes to power that Azariahu of the south, Azariahu ben Amatz of the south, comes to rule during the 27th year of Yerubbaal of the north. That's not what the number 27 means. It means something else, which is the number of years that Azariah of the south ruled independently, which means that they ruled together for 27 years. It wasn't that he came to power during the 27th year of Yerubbaal II of the north. It was that they ruled as co-rulers, not co-rulers, each one had his own country, but at the same time, and they cooperated for 27 years. Why then does it use the 27th year in a different language here? So that's difficult to say. But I'll prove to you at the end, or I'll attempt to prove to you that it was the 27th year, it was essentially for 27 years that they ruled synchronously. Perhaps there was no better way to say it, so they said as they said, and it yielded to such confusion. And even the Midrashim recognized the problem, by the way, because you could figure out the numbers by the children very easily, who ruled in whose time. And it's very clear what happened on the 27th year. What happened on the 27th year of independent rule by Azariahu is that he went into the Beit HaMikdash and he got struck down by a plague. However, he didn't die. His son Yotam takes over. That was in the 22nd year of his independent rule. But if you remember, his father Amatziahu had to run away to Lachish for 15 years. So if you take 27 years and you add 15 and then you add the other 12, then you get the 52. And it works out perfectly. So essentially what you have is you have Azariahu / Uzziahu is a co-regent in his father's time while his father is ruling over Lachish for 15 years. Then Azariahu gets the nod himself. At the same time, Yerubbaal II of the north becomes king at the same time. They rule for 27 years. Then Azariahu walks into the Beit HaMikdash and makes a tremendous mistake. His son Yotam takes over while Azariahu is still alive, which means the 52 years are not over, but effectively the rulership is over, and Yerubbaal is still going strong. Now, if you do it that way, so essentially he overlaps his father on 15 years on the inside. His son overlaps him, Azariahu, by, I believe, 12 years on the outside, maybe 18. Well, hold on, so let me do the math. 27 plus 15 is 30, 42. He will for 52 years, it was 10 years. So Yotam overlaps his father of 10 years, essentially has 27 years of independent rule, which is also not terrible, to be honest. That's not a bad, it's not the 52 years that we really, you know, that's a 52-year king is powerful. 41s of Yerubbaal of the north, of Yerubbaal II, that's very powerful. There are very few kings that ruled quite that long. Even the great Ramses II ruled for 68 years. So that's a good long time. Buried almost all of his kids. They died in his old age. He was a good old guy. It wasn't giving up the ghost. A little bit like Queen Elizabeth. What's the queen now in England?
Elizabeth.
Yeah. So, you know, she's just living so long that essentially the kids are going to be old, and theoretically, it's not quite that bad, but I imagine that, well, I may have asked him, I guess, but I don't know, but I imagine King, what's his name,
Charles,
will be around while his mother dies, but theoretically you have situations where Prince, but essentially you have situations where the prince never really makes it to the king because the father outlives him. In this case, he rules for 68 years. He must have been 70-something, which is quite a feat back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially buried almost all of his kids. And in fact, with his death, his son takes over for a very small period of time, fights against Israel for the first time, rules about 12 years, And that's the end of the end of the dynasty. That's the 18th dynasty. Gone goodbye. It doesn't exist. It's called the Ramses dynasty. The next dynasty is began by a ruler by the name of Ramses III. The reason why he did that is because he wanted to make it seem like he was the son of Ramses II to continue the dynasty. But it's not his son. It's not his son at all. And that's the 19th dynasty, not the 18th dynasty. Maybe it's 19th or 20th. I can't remember. But anyway, so you get these situations where people bury their, where essentially the people outlast their kids, and it creates a great deal of instability in the kingdom. But anyway, getting back to chapter 14, verse 24. What's that? What?
Bad joke.
Okay. Vayatzara b'nei Hashem. So he does bad. Lo sar mikol chatat Yeravam ben Nevat asher achtiya Yisrael, which means Yeravam the second does the sins of Yeravam the first, which are, it's standard. This is the Egel Zahav worship, which again is not a Vodat Elilim, but it is a strange worship, an unacceptable worship, but it's not nearly as bad as Achav. Whether the Asherah is still around, we don't know. If you remember, Hoshea did a lot of complaining about the Asherah. Whether the Asherah is around, we still don't know. But it seems actually things are going pretty well, and I'll show you why. Because right after you're told that a king has done bad, you expect there to be some kind of godly recompense. But that's what happens in verse 25. Verse 25 is a shocker, by the way. Who has shivat gvul Yisrael? He restored the border boundaries of Israel. Milavo chamat ad yad marava. And from essentially deep into Syrian territory, Levo Hamat is, you know, deep past the Litani River, really deep into northern Lebanon and Syria. Kidvar Adonai Elohei Yisrael Asher Diber Biad Avdo Yonah Ben Amitai Anavi Asher Migat Chefer. And there we have Yonah Ben Amitai, who shows up three times in Tanakh, once here, once in Melachet, once in Divrei Yamim, and once in his own Sefer. This pasuk makes it incredibly difficult to pretend that Yonah, the story of Yonah, was an imaginary story by a made-up person. Because Yonah ben Amitai is not only, this one pasuk, to my mind, profoundly affects the way that one approaches the book of Yonah. Because
Yonah is Yonah ben Amitai.
That's the same. None other, they lived at the same time.
Uh-huh.
It changes everything, because first of all, Yonah ben Amitai is his foreign minister. Yonah ben Amitai told him, God has asked you to go and conquer territories back all the way up to Northern Territory, which is interesting because God is upset at him. You would imagine God is upset at him. Why? Because Yeravam II is a calf worshiper, or at least supports the cult of the golden calf. But I guess he liked them enough. We'll see why. God has a little sympathy for Israel. God is afraid that Israel will be destroyed. But the bottom line is you have bad guys that are nearly destroying Israel, and God doesn't come over to help them out. Here, God sets him up with a prophet. And apparently they're on good relationship. He is the foreign minister. He says, you know what? God just told me to tell you something. And you know, Rabbi Segev says, what? He goes, go conquer the northern countries. And he says, okay, God says it, I'll go do it. I'm sure it didn't hurt him either. I'm sure it was in his own self-interest. But it's clear that Rabbi II and God through Yonah ben Amitai are on the same page. So first of all, it changes everybody always imagines Yonah as this bedraggled prophet with a scratched beard and the scrabbly beard and the ripped clothes. He wasn't. He was a major player. He was the Condoleezza Rice of the generation. Not only that, he went to Nineveh. People always ask, why would people, the famous bad question, which is why would Nineveh listen to a guy named Yonah ben Amitai that they never heard of before? They absolutely heard him before. He was the most powerful prophet of his time. Absolutely heard of him. The question wasn't the question that you should ask isn't why they listened to Yonah ben Amitai. The question is why didn't they have Yonah ben Amitai killed immediately? That's a good question. Because Yonah ben Amitai is the one who's having him take territory all the way into the northern border, which encroaches on Assyrian territory, capital of Assyria being Nineveh, exactly right. So it's not as simplistic as that story seems. It's a very complex the book of Yonah, even though it's only four chapters long, read without this pasuk and without an awareness of what's going on in the Near East, is pales. You miss most of the story, in my humble opinion. That is, the book does not stand by itself. The book stands as any op-ed stands, which is based on the fact that people know what's going on at the time and that they read the rest of Tanakh. So Rambam says that the whole story is completely made up. What can I tell you? Doesn't seem made up, it seems quite practical. Seems quite reasonable that Yonah would be pretty upset that God wants Nineveh to survive. He's no idiot. He's a master. He's a politician or a foreign minister, perhaps the head of the armies. It's hard to say. Anyway, it's a good piece. This is Yonah ben Amitai, and then Chazal have a dispute about whether they want to go to town on Yonah ben Amitai, because it says in the famous Medrash by Yonah that God spoke to Yonah second about Nineveh. So there's a medrash that says God spoke to him a second time, but he refused to speak to him a third time. A criticism of Yoel ben Amittai. And there was a dispute in the Gemara about whether that means that God didn't speak to him at all, in which case it has to deal with how is it possible that God is speaking to Yonah here, which I'm not going to get into resolution of. And others say he only spoke to him twice about Nineveh, but he continued to have a good relationship with Yonah. Okay, because it's not just some crazy guy that nobody's ever heard of who gets on a ship and runs away. I mean, it's it's a major
change.
It makes it much more poignant and much it makes it much more sinful, really, the act that he does. The fact that these sailors wouldn't know who he was is reasonable, because it wasn't like they had newspapers and television. So if these sailors come from Tarshish, which was probably Tarsus is probably in Asia Minor in Turkey. So it's reasonable they wouldn't know exactly who he does if he dressed up like a standard Joe. What's amazing is that essentially the leader of the Jewish religious people of the north would run away. It's not just some prophet who doesn't want to listen to the word of God. It's some prophet who's heavily involved in the entire geopolitics of the time. It just creates a whole different scenario to the story of Yonah, although we're not doing Yonah here. But I guess we are. But I can't wait to do Yeshayahu. Yeshayahu is what I want to do here.
Yeah.
But it really changed things. What did you want to say, Sarah? I cut you off.
I forget. Oh, I just asked. This comes before the book of Yonah.
Impossible.
Or does it?
Impossible to tell.
Oh, well, that's what I was asking.
There is no way to know.
All right.
There's no way to know. Here he is obviously a position of power, but since Yonah starts off with him being a prophet of God and ends off with him being a prophet of God, because eventually he's reaccepted as, he accepts God's will.
Yeah.
So it's hard to say. So I think that the story could have taken place either before this or after this. My feeling, however, to make the story much more poignant, is that the Yonah story happens afterwards, which means after Yonah's become recognized as a political leader, and after he's been told to take back territory specifically to come into direct confrontation with Assyria, Assyria, and then God's request that he go to the capital of Assyria after everybody knows who he is. Also, in my opinion, I don't like that. The reason why God chose Yonah is because he was the only guy they would listen to. It's like only Nixon could. What's that famous line about
China.
Nixon and China?
China.
Yeah. So it strikes me that the story of Yonah takes place afterwards, because the only way God could... it just doesn't make sense for the Ninevites to listen to nobody, but it does make sense for the Ninevites to listen to a major player. It's not directly against him. He's taking property back from Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But taking back property from Syria puts you up into a territorial conflict with Assyria. Essentially, the two of them squeeze Syria out at this time. Hazael was a powerful leader. We met him last time here, but he dies and his son takes over, Ben-Hadad, and Ben-Hadad is a real loser. We'll meet him during the course of, maybe not today, maybe next week, but he's not a powerful leader, and all of a sudden Assyria starts to disappear. He's not a powerful leader. Second of all, Israel is on the rise again. Assyria, with Tiglath-Pileser III, and before that, there are others, is really in ascension. Babylon, actually, at this point, is in a decline. And Assyria, which would be everywhere from, let's say, the Mosul area, so you're talking about northern Iraq and Kurdistan, that area, is on a tremendous rise. So Syria is squozed out. So I don't think he ever fought against them, but I think he was fighting with them over who gets to eat up parts of, maybe a little bit like America and Russia during the end of World War II, where they're all jockeying for who's going to take up pieces. Right, exactly right. So that's the kind of environment that you have. Although I doubt very much that Israel was considered a superpower back then. Assyria was a superpower. But Israel is certainly significant enough to be annoying to Assyria. I don't know what you'd call them. The truth is, you might call Israel then what Israel is today. I'm not sure I would define Israel as a superpower. I mean, if Russia ever decided to go nuts, or if America decided to go nuts, so Israel, I think, would be in, other than having God's help, I don't think it would stand much of a chance. So Israel is powerful, but you have to be reasonable within the geopolitical scheme. Powerful is powerful, but superpower is superpower. And that's probably pretty close to what was going on then. Yeah. Yeah, so imagine 20 years ago, I can't remember his name, the one with the peace treaty, Menachem Begin, going to Moscow at the time during the heart of the Cold War and explaining to Moscow that they better stop with all their arm buildups or God's going to wipe them out, And that would be very strange. That would just be a very strange thing, although very effective if it worked. Anyway, I guess, well, I think they would know them enough to listen to them, but it creates a whole dynamic. Anyway, let me go back to the verses. So verse 26, Kira'a Hashem et Oni Yisrael Moreh Ma'od, because God saw the poorness of Israel. Moreh Ma'od is a very difficult word, Moreh. Moreh means, it could mean to teach, could be fearful, but then it should have an aleph at the end from the word Yira'a. It could mean raining down. The word Yoreh Tzedek actually could mean raining down like a...
Yeah, exactly right.
The Targum just translates Moreh as Chazak, and I think avoids all of the issues. That is, he saw that they were very poor. Yeah, it would be nice if it wasn't for that cholam there, Moreh. I mean, it would be nice if it was Mara, but it's not. It's Moreh. So it's hard to go with that translation. Although it's certainly possible. The Efes Asur, the Efes Azur, the Einos early Israel means Israel's in big trouble. But the weird thing about that is Israel's really not that in bad shape. Israel was probably in that bad shape before Yeravam came to power. But once Yeravam comes to power and be a successful leader, which means that God's decision to save Israel is really through Yeravam and probably Yeravam's father, because Yeravam and Yoash, if you remember, Yoash was the guy who saved his father. So the question is, remember his father, Yoash, his father was Yoachaz, who was in deadly trouble. And God sends the salvation that we discovered was the son, Yehoash, who was more successful against Hazael than his father. So it's hard to say that Yeravam was a bad guy, he was doing very poor in the country, he was bad, and then God comes over and says, I'm going to do you a favor. That's just not practical to say.
Maybe
that. What it means
is that he became successful.
Yeravam,
because the country was in deep, dire straits.
But 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it was in dire straits, but not now. So you have to read the Pesukim carefully. I think what the Navi wants to say here is that, I think what the Navi wants to do is resolve a problem. The problem is, here's a guy who worships Diego, which we've established is not a good thing. And here's a guy that not only is a super powerful king, but the Navi himself, one of the greatest Navis that we know, or the most famous Navi that we know, is helping him out. So which is it, good guy or bad guy? So I think what he's saying is, listen, if God took away his power... Well, that's true. Also, what he's trying to say is that maybe if God would take away his power, then Israel would be destroyed right away because Assyria was on the rise, and therefore God needs to put in a little extra help and make powerful. But the bottom line is, the Navi is struggling hard, everybody is struggling hard to figure out why a bad guy is doing so well. And he does, 41-year rule, that's a solid rule. And he comes to power.
But doesn't Yeravam the first have the same scenario? He does very well,
though. He does, but the Nevi'im never communicate with him. Achia Shiloni won't have anything to do with him. He curses, remember when the wife shows up, she dresses up to get a good bracha, and it's not only that he's successful.
He's not doing what was right in the eyes.
That Yeravam the first.
Yeah.
I agree with you, but here he's got sanctioned from, you would say Yeravam the second is sanctioned from God. Yonah ben Amittai is talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to him, helping him, God's helping him out. So it's a much tighter relationship than Yeravam the first. So it's hard to say. I mean, look, there's just not everything, religiously, sometimes things don't always, bad things happen to good people, good things happen to bad people. God has a plan. It's not always clear what the plan is. Here, according to the Navi, is that Israel needed the help, because without a powerful king, Israel would have been destroyed, which is possibly true. Which seems like
Hashem
what?
Hashem wants to take care of the destruction
himself. The question is why would he save him here but not 20 years later when Hoshea ben Ela goes belly up in his ninth year, and then there's no more Israel? Why was God interested in saving the poorness then, not the poorness now? So
we don't know.
All we have is the book in front of us. What I can tell you is Yehu was a powerful king, whose sons were, except for Yoachaz, was a weak king, but Yoash was a powerful king, and Yeravam the second was a powerful king. These are powerful kings that at the very least, know how to take care of their own. There's some certain stability, and perhaps they're rewarded for that stability. What we're going to see in a few years after Yeravam dies is we have kings lasting a month, 6 months, 2 years.
This
what's that? The what?
Very sickly king.
Yeah, well, kings without good defense systems, essentially.
Yeah.
Kings that... They're a little too
smart.
Yeah. So there's assassinations are rife. So one could say, if one looks at it as from a non-spiritual way, one could just say that a government that can't keep a king for more than a month because everybody's murdering everybody really is likely to fall apart and be destroyed. Or one could say spiritually that at least if you don't have a society that at least takes care of ensuring non-anarchy, then you have a society which God does not deserve his keeping, which gets you to the whole Ben Adam B'Chaveiro. I can worship idols as much as I want, but as long as I'm not stealing from my neighbor, so I'm not that bad. Yerubam is ruling for 41 years. They're reconquering territory. People are wealthy. People are doing well. At least Yerubam is taking care of his own. And we saw that by Ahab also. Ahab was a terrible guy in Baal worship. And what did he get nailed for? He got nailed for stealing property away from Naboth HaKarmeli and then tricking other people into lying about it. So that's, I think, a message through Malachim, which is not a new idea, that a Ben Adam HaKaveiro is a much more deadly sin than a Ben Adam HaMakom. So that's my sense of things. That's my sense of things. Anyway, to continue on. Chaf Zayin. V'lo diber Adonai l'mchot et shem Yisrael b'tachar ha-shamayim. God had not spoken. Now here, by the way, is a very good proof for the word diber, meaning commanded. Doesn't mean to speak, right? V'lo diber Adonai l'mchot et shem Yisrael. You can't say he didn't speak to wipe out the name of Israel. What it means is he didn't command. What do you have in English there? What? Yeah, that's not right. It just doesn't... You ignore the prepositional phrase of limchot. Limchot is a preposition. It's limchot at Israel. God did not say to... And then essentially you have like a nominative. You have a thing. God did not say to do something. And that's... I'm sorry, not a nominative, a gerund.
And the Lord said not that he would block out the name of Israel.
Yeah, but that, you know what that's doing? That's that would be v'lo diber Hashem sheyeh, you know, yimcheh. That takes that prepositional phrase of limchot and ignores the fact that it's a noun, really, and not a verb. So really what's going on here is this is one of the proofs that is a strong philological proof that diber really means command, which we sort of know anyway. If I diber Hashem el Moshe lemor, wasn't really that he was speaking to him, is that he's commanding him. But it also would affect you on things like diber Eliyahu, you know, asher diber biyad Eliyahu. And it doesn't seem... And there's a certain sense of command with the word diber.
Well, asher asher dibros.
Exactly. That's
always command.
What's that? Dabar is a leader. You're right. And in fact, dabar means to. It's in Aramaic, it's a verb which means to lead or to carry out. Correct. Exactly right. And therefore, but this is like a real good proof because a lot of times people have a hard time with that because in most cases it could be used as either to say or to command. It works both ways. But here it can't be to say because you have that prepositional phrase limchot it and shame Israel. Unless you take that and you retranslate that also, which is cheating. Anyway, Akhtiwa, we talk about Shemayim, Yoshim, Biyad, Yeravam, Ben Yerah. So we say, V'yeta divrei Yeravam, Chol Asher Asag, V'rato, Asheracham, Asher Yishiv, et Damet. Now, here's the cool part, in Chavchat. All of his battles, all of his greatness, Asher Yishiv, et Damesek, V'et Chamat, Liudav, Yisrael. He returned Damascus, and Chamah, which is in northern Lebanon, southern Syria, Liudav, Yisrael, to Judah, in Israel. What does your English do with that? By the way,
says that the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he warred and how he recovered Damascus and Hamath for Judah and Israel.
So that's
in the book of Chronicles of the Kings of Israel.
Yeah, which means that they are. Halohem really means indeed they are. It's a sort of rhetorical set. But essentially, what seems to be happening is that he's now in your translation. It became Israelite territory, but once upon a time Yehuda owned it, although when that happened we don't have no idea. What's more likely is that it was the kingdom was really reuniting to a certain extent. Not completely. One king had his thing, another king had this thing, but apparently Israel was nice enough, Yerubbaal was nice enough. Perhaps he was paid off. We'll find out the armies of, I don't know if we'll find out today, but we'll find out the armies of Uzziahu / Azariah, the king of Judah, are incredibly powerful. For all we know, he said, listen, I'll give you 20,000 troops, you take this territory, but I want Damascus. And the guy said, good, your Damascus is yours. So just the fact that they take Damascus is significant. The fact that he takes Damascus and then gives it to Judahite territory shows you that there's a certain merging of the countries. Each one owns a little bit of territory in the other guy's country, which is indicates a real cooperation, which is a good thing for Israel. This is really golden age. But of course, Yirmiyahu is not interested in the golden age because Yirmiyahu knows that it's all going to come to an end. So all this golden age is summed up in one pasuk. All of the great things that he did, and he took this land, all those are written in the book. If you're interested in that kind of history, go look it up. But I'm talking about something else completely. And that's really the tragedy to a certain extent because we've lost those books and we don't know exactly what it was, although according to Yirmiyahu it was insignificant. Chavtet, Vayishkab Yerav and Ravatani, Malchay Yisrov, Yimlof Zachariah, Ben Otachdav.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You skipped over a series of phrases, and I'd like you to explain them briefly.
Yeah.
In Kaf Vav.
Yeah. The Efes Atzur, the Efes Azur? Very difficult. The Radak quotes his father on this. It shows up every now and then. It shows up in the Tochacha, Efes Atzur, the Efes Azur, I think. It's either in the Tocha or it's in Vayikra's Tocha. I can't remember. I believe Efes Atzur, the Efes Azur. What I believe it means is as follows. Atzur means nobody left. Atzur means nobody gathered together. From the word la'atzur means to stop, but it means to also, like atzeret, to gather people together. It means that normally you had at least people gathered together in the walled cities that could at least hold on to the fundamental ownership of the country. So Efes Atzur means you don't even have walled cities where people can take refuge in. Efes Azuv is similar. The word Azuv, I can't go into now because I don't know where it is off the top of my head. Although Radak points out a pasuk, I believe it's in Yeshayahu, that Azuv also means to build, even though Azuv sounds like left, like La'azov, it also means to build walls. So Efes Azuv means no walls being built, no fortifications being built. How does your English translate it?
There was not any shut up, nor any left free.
Yeah.
Nor any helper.
So it's hard to really say what that means. What does that mean, shut up or left free?
There was none shut up nor left at large, neither was there any helper for Israel.
So you know what that could, so that what that means is you didn't have anybody in the cities, you didn't have anybody in the fields, essentially you had a complete depopulation. That would be the way he reads that. But the Radak is convincing.
How can you have a
complete depopulation?
Yeah, and then all of a sudden have a thriving country.
That's correct. So it's a little difficult. I prefer Radak, which is Efes Azuv, which means nobody was able to build walls. So essentially you had people living in caves, hiding out, trying to stay low, but you had nobody being able to pull together fortifications, because the minute somebody built a bridge, it was blown up, that type of thing. The minute somebody put together a battlement, it was torn down by the enemies. By the enemies. That's what Efes Azuv is. Unfortunately, we don't know who those enemies are. That's the confusing part. Because again, his father, Yehoash, had successfully beaten off Hazael. Was somebody else? Was there an Assyrian play into Israel that we're not aware of? It doesn't show up in Assyrian documentation. Hard to say. I can't tell. What is very interesting is Tiglath-Pileser the First, I believe, shows up, and there's actually a picture of this. I'm sorry I don't have it, with Yehu. That is the grandfather, great-grandfather of Yeravam the Second, bowing down to the Assyrian king and offering him vassalage and money. So even though in our Tanakh Assyria doesn't show up until later,
Yehu
was a powerful king. You would seem, one wouldn't think he was oppressed by Assyria, but the documentation has it. We even have a picture of it. It's a picture with it written specifically, Yehu of Israel giving fealty to Assyrian king. Not everything is in here, only the things which are religiously significant according to the prophets. Or God didn't tell the prophets about it. The prophets, as far as they were concerned, the fact that Assyria came around and played a little game on Israel was completely and totally unimportant. And I'll tell you why it's unimportant. This is an issue that I have. The same question with Yonah. Why would Yonah save Nineveh if Nineveh is the worst thing since sliced toast? And the answer is Nineveh is not the worst thing since sliced toast. Bavel is the worst thing since sliced toast. Bavel will destroy Israel, not Assyria. And in fact, it's because Assyria is destroyed that Bavel has a free, Bavel has to go through Assyrian territory, because you can only go up through the Mesopotamia, through the Tigris and the fertile crescent between the fertile area between the Tigris to the north and Euphrates to the left, to the south. You have to cross that territory. What?
Modern day Jordan.
Modern day Jordan is in the way. It's all desert.
You don't want to have Iran and Israel.
What's that? Oh, that's correct. Jordan becomes a buffer against Iraq. That's true. Back then, there was a territorial buffer also, which is that you couldn't move troops across the Jordan area because the Arabian Desert was non-travelable by troops. That's why Egypt was always safer, because it was hard to cross the Sinai Peninsula with troops. It was done by Ashurbanipal, but you should read the stories. Two-headed snakes that bite them all the time. All kinds of... They were in shock and fear trying to cross the peninsula. Now, you know,
shock
you bring up...
Awe.
What's that? Shock and awe? Thank you. Is that the... where is that from?
It's from Bush.
Oh, is it?
Bush.
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 Okay.
No. Shaka was the second.
Shaka was the second.
The
second one. I think the first one was
the
Thousand
Storm.
No.
Desert Storm was Shaka and Awe.
No.
Tried to merge into one. So essentially, when Assyria is destroyed, falls apart, that's when Nebuchadnezzar has a free reign into Israel.
Yeah,
so sometimes
who, wait a minute. First of all, who's Sancheriv? Babel or
Sancheriv is Asher. Sancheriv
right,
gives a hard time.
Destroys
northern Israel, but does not succeed in destroying southern Israel.
Right, but if you're only worried here about northern Israel,
that you're right. So the question is, why isn't it included? But don't forget that Yirmiyahu has an editorial hand. Yirmiyahu is deciding the message. These are a lot of little messages that were given by the prophets of the time, but the book itself is the big message as delivered by Yirmiyahu. The question is, did Yirmiyahu cut out the Assyrian intervention to Israel? Could be. Keep in mind that Assyria was very, very far away and did not have the ability to sustain troops. Syria did, but Assyria didn't. So the fact that Assyria comes over and says, I've got thousands of troops and I'll come over and you give me money, and he says, okay, I'll give you money, but it could just be sort of a protocol type of thing. So for the Assyrians, it's a big deal. For the Israelis, there's a bunch of meanies. They come around, they stay a few years and they give us a hard time, and they go back home to their very, very far away country. And it was incredibly far away to move troops all the way through Mesopotamia and then around to the Mediterranean, then down to the south. For Israel, it was insignificant. Either it was religiously insignificant or politically, but there's no doubt that Assyria was involved in Israel politics. We just don't know everything. Not everything is available to us. And I'm not sure that was intentional. I think the prophets may have wanted more to be available to us. Halo heim tuvim al sefer divrei hayamim. The assumption is that
you
the...
Want to cut out?
Feel free to... Here. There you go. What's that? Yeah, that's what Hello Haim Tuvim Al Sefer Divrei Hayamim. Go look it up. The problem is we can't look it up anymore. So we're missing all kinds of stuff that we simply don't know about. The question is, does Tanakh stand by itself? So religiously, of course, it stands by itself because everything religious is important to be there. But you really have to know you have to have some knowledge of... it may not stand by itself, the truth is. You may have to have some knowledge of the environment. Without knowing more or less what's going on. It doesn't. You get a lot of religious moral message out of it. It's not like it's a wasted book. But you're missing some important information. Now, Bereishit is so old that the emphasis is on religion rather than... Bereishit is Torah. The emphasis is on religion. I think it stands... It's all about the chosen people and why we were chosen and why it's never the oldest kid and who gets... And what's a sin and what's exile and what's redemption... So there the book stands, I think, more on its own. But here in Malachim, when it, to a certain degree, is a historical book, so that's when you start really needing a little bit help from the historical side. I'm not saying it doesn't stand on its own. You can learn Malachim by itself without knowledge of history and get a lot out of it. But I don't think you could squeeze every last drop out, and I think there's some stuff which is downright confusing. I don't know whether it's a proof, but I think the proof is, I mean, if somebody could argue me this, and they could say, when it says, Elohim tuvim al divrei sefer divrei hayamim, go look it up in the Chronicles, maybe they're being dismissive, which means, I don't want to talk about it, it's not important to me. If you're a history buff, go look it up. Or it could be that it's saying that if you want to get a full picture of this king and what was going on, so then you have to look at the Chronicles. I tend to the second, but one could argue that it's the first easily. But anyway, let's continue on to Azariahu. So Azariahu... I don't think we won't have enough time to cover him completely, but let's read the 6-7 psukim. B'shnat esrim v'sheva shana liyaravam melech Yisrael, malach Azariyahu ben Amatsiyahu melech Yudah. Then sheshtrei shana hayab macho, he rules at 16. Don't forget, he rules at 16 because his father, who loses a battle against Hazael and has to give up all the money from the Beit HaMikdash, gets chased to Lachish and is killed 15 years later. During those 15 years... Oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. We're on chapter 15, verse 1. During those 15 years, his son, who's 16 years old, rules from 16 to 31 as a co-regent, but his father was still a big player, and Lachish was like New York City. Lachish was the second most powerful city, like modern-day Tel Aviv. Lachish was the second most powerful city. It is easily the most defensible city next to Jerusalem, and is the second most powerful city in the state of Israel at that time. And therefore, his father was certainly a player until somebody sent him out to assassinate him. How do we know that? Because why bother to assassinate a guy who's in exile and has no effect on anything? Obviously, he did have effect. So there's a co-ruling going on, and there must be a certain tension going on between father and son. But how it plays out, we don't know. So anyway, Ben Cheshire Shana Yam Malcho, V'chamishim U'shtayim Shana Malach Yushlaim. So he ruled 52 years, which again is impressive, but also not quite that impressive. V'shem Imo Yecholia Yushlaim. His mother's name was Yecholia. He was a firm guy. So he didn't get rid of the decentralized worship. People still sacrificing in their backyards. People still do their own little backyard sacrifices, like shtibles. God plagued him. It made him a mitzora, a a leper, or tarche, and he sat in the free house. The free house, by the way, is a word that we know now from Ugaritic. We guessed what it was, but now we know exactly what it was, because it's Ugaritic, which is a very old language. The word chofshit means chofshit from your soul, as in it's a dead house. They used to take all of the chofshit, meaning the house of the dead, because they would take, essentially, all these lepers, and they would put them there, and nobody would have anything to do with them. It was considered, essentially, it was like the Molokai Island back in the early, late 1800s. You went there to die. I mean, you went there to be removed from society because the lepers were all taken out. V'yotam ben ha-melech al ha-bayit. Oh, I'm sorry, where was I? Right, v'yotam ben ha-melech al ha-bayit. So Yotam, the son of the king, is on the house. Shofeit et am ha-aretz. So now he's the ruler, but he's not the king. He's the ruler, but he's not the king. V'yeta divrei Azariah v'chol asher asa. Halohim tuvim al-sefer divrei ha-yamin u'malchei Yudah. Read it, everything he did. When he died, Yotam takes over. Which is all very nice. So here is a king that ruled 52 years. We have no information about him and no information about Yerubbaal. Nothing, squat, nothing. You don't know what they did. We know that they managed to conquer territory all the way back to Damascus. That's pretty significant. And yet he gets no psukim of what he did. And not only that, you don't know, the most important thing that we don't know is why he became a mature. With no clue. There's no information here whatsoever. Yirmiyahu is uninterested in telling us the story. As far as he's concerned, those 52 years are a bleep on religious history. They concern us not at all. Not at all. I would like to show you something very interesting, however.
So that's in Divrei Hayamin?
We're going to go to Divrei Hayamin. I'm sorry, I use a lot of time talking about this and that. So God willing, I should be here next week. What? He sure got full of himself. Or he called the man of the earth. There's all kinds of things going on. And he went to do a sacrifice. Yeshayahu spends chapters on him, but he never mentions him by name. And Kadosh Hashem's vote happened when? At that time was when Azariah went in to do a sacrifice. Oh, there's a tremendous amount of stuff on this, but what's interesting, again, is that Yirmiyahu, from the perspective of Sefer Malachim, doesn't interest him. Because he's not, it's insignificant. Now, really for two reasons. One is because don't forget that this book, Yirmiyahu is collecting, this is a book written by the northern kings. Until chapter 13, and I think somebody actually did the percentage, after Shlomo HaMelech, starting from Yerubbaal, the first, until essentially Yerubbaal the second, his son Zechariah, and then Hosea to the end, 82% of the time is on the north, and 18% is on the south. Why? Because this book is being written by the northern prophets. All the prophets we've met up to this point are northern prophets, not southern prophets. Even Achiah Shiloni, who spoke to Shlomo, was a northern prophet. Yeshayahu is a northern prophet. Yeshayahu is a southern prophet, but he doesn't play here. Who plays here? Eliyahu, northern prophet. Elisha, northern prophet. Yonah ben Amittai, northern prophets. These are all northern prophets. All the southern prophets, we don't hear about until Sefer Divrei Hayamim. So this book essentially is the one reason that Yirmiyahu is not, the book is not interested in it, is because Yirmiyahu essentially cut and paste to a certain degree. I mean, it wasn't just that simplistic, but Yirmiyahu is at the very end of destruction of the temple. There is no, southern, that's correct. But he's collecting material that is available at the time. What's available at the time is not much about the south. That is, the book that he turned into Malachim is the stories of Shlomo, big book of the north, and then once the north falls, now you're getting into his territory, which is what's going on with Bavel and the Nebuchadnezzar. Everything else is essentially focused on the north. Because it's focused on the northern prophets do not care to speak about Amatziah or Azariah. It doesn't really interest him. Why doesn't Yirmiyahu reconstitute it? So then why doesn't Yirmiyahu say, listen, I am of the south, so why don't I tell you what Amatziah did? Because he did terrible things. And I would like to tell you about those terrible things, because those terrible things don't interest him. Because don't forget that he's dealing with the destruction of the temple and the destruction of the state of Israel. He's not worried about kings with big egos. That's not his problem. He's worried about getting a king on the throne in the first place. Ezra of Divrei Hayamim is dealing with kings with big egos, or Kohanim with big egos, or the conflict between... Ezra has a state. What interests him is how a king behaves on a state. You know, I was less interested in how a king behaves on a state. Because that's not why, not only that, but it's another thing I'd like to propose. I don't know for sure. All these are just conjectures. The only thing we know for sure is he gets no press time. He gets no press time whatsoever.
I didn't hear that
the class is at 7:15. I'm sorry, I'll do it again. I'll say I'll do it again. It's not that good of a shiur, but I'm going to do it again. I'll sum up at least.
Okay.
So at 8
to
so 8
next week are we going to do it at 7:15?
Next week we're going to do it at 7:15 because otherwise we conflict with davening. I think that there's another reason. I'm going to redo it. Everybody, when we break up, I'll go over it a little bit. Although I'm going to interfere with Mincha Maariv, so it's your choice.
I can't do that.
Yeah, my apologies. My apologies. It's recorded though.
Allow him to tune in.
Yeah, if we ever lose the MP3 files, we're in trouble. Here's another reason I think why. And now the question is, why doesn't Yirmiyahu, who is a southern king, reconstitute all this information? It was clearly available, otherwise Ezra wouldn't have it for his book, which was 150-200 years later. And I think the answer is, and it's just conjecture, is because Yirmiyahu knows that Amatzia didn't destroy. Yirmiyahu knows that the reason why Israel is destroyed is by Nebuchadnezzar destroying the final kings of Israel because of the things that they did, the toivot that they did that we're not going to get to, but they're at the end. Amatzia is not interested in Yirmiyahu. If it's not already in the book, he's not going to reconstitute, because Amatzia did not cause the destruction of the state of Israel. He had problems, but the fact that he tried to grab the kahuna away, it doesn't interest Yirmiyahu, because that's not the destruction of Israel. Read Sefer Yirmiyahu. It has nothing to do with the fact, and Yirmiyahu is a Kohen. Yirmiyahu is not accusing people of stealing away time from the Kohanim and doing bad things and worshiping. He's talking about Moloch worship. He's talking about cheating people. He's talking about kangaroo court systems. He's not interested in those things, and therefore I believe he doesn't reconstitute information that was clearly available to him. Ezra, who is worried, not only has a kingship of Israel, or at least a some type of autonomous state, and he is interested in how people behave, and he is very much interested in the conflict between Melucha and Kahuna, which we've seen over and over, he is going to reconstitute all of that material from Azariah, and explain to you why Azariah was a terrible guy. Now here's something very interesting I want to show you. Take a look at Yotam. Let's skip over to Yotam. Now here it doesn't tell you who Yotam's mother's name was. It doesn't tell you.
What line are
you on? I was on chapter 16, verse 1.
Chapter 16?
Chapter 16, 1-6, verse 1. We do not know what his mother's name was. Why is it important to know what his mother's name is? So here what I'm going to ask you to do is, if you have a Tanakh, open up to Divrei Hayamim, chapter Bet, so Chronicles 2, chapter 20.
Are we talking about Yotam?
The son of, we're talking about the son of Azariahu. I'll read it to you, it'll become clear in a second. Chapter 27. Benesrim, what's that?
No,
I'll just read to you. It'll be very straightforward. It's Chronicles 2, chapter 27, verse 1. Benesrim chamesh shana Yotam malcho v'sheisrei shana malach v'yushalayim v'shem imo Yerusha bat Tzadok. His mother's name was Yerusha, the daughter of Tzadok, and Tzadok is only from one tribe. Tzadok is always, always a Kohen. Tzadok is always a Kohen. What happened? Azariah goes into the throne. He's kicked out by the Kohanim. The Kohanim take him out when he gets to the plague. So there's this battle between Kohen and Malchut, who has the right to do service in the temple. They drag him out, essentially, and I'm sure he wants to be dragged out because he's got leprosy. They put him in this Beit HaChofshit. They essentially intern the king. They dethrone the king, functionally. They establish the son. Now, we don't know if Yotam's the oldest son. We don't know. But we do know something very interesting about him, was that his mother was a Kohen. A Bas Kohen. Which means, you see the politics going on here? So the Kohanim are putting their thing down, is what they're doing. I'll tell you who's going to be the next line. Now maybe Yotam was also the oldest, I don't know. Maybe there was a weird relationship where he was very tight with the Kohen. I could interpret it a different way, which is also interesting, which is that why does Azariah think he was a Kohen? He was marrying into Kuna. He thought he could combine the whole thing together. So that's why Yotam was Bako. But the very fact that Yotam, his son, is Bako and speaks volumes. Of course, you wouldn't know that from Divrei Yamin, because again, from Malachim, because simply he's not, they're just not interested in it. So anyway, so we finished up to chapter 15, verse 7. What we didn't do is the long story of Azariah Uzziahu, the king who gets too haughty and becomes a leper. It's an incredibly important story in Divrei Yamim. So that's what, God willing, I should be here next week. That's what, God willing, we will do next week. We'll spend most of our time on Divrei Yamim. He gets a whole lot of play, maybe 50, 60 psukim at least. We'll analyze him, and then I should have one more week left, and by then we'll just finish up all the assassinations and get to the end of Northern Israel. I hate to get depressing, but it is a little bit depressing. So. My job starts on January 1st. August 1st.
August.
Our apartment is ready 15 days before that, on the 15th. So we'll be here to mid-July and then leave. So we have about 3 weeks left, I guess. Maybe 4. Can I apologize? I'd like to apologize. I made a promise to stay a little bit afterwards, but I have to run over to Or Torah. And I feel bad that you didn't know, but next week at 7:15,
yeah.
I apologize very much. Hopefully I didn't waste your time.
No,
okay.